So I have two special guests now, one of them here in the studio with me and one of them on the phone, and they are brother and sister, but they also have something else in common, and this is really remarkable. First, let me introduce the both of them. On the phone, we have Sylvia Neal. Welcome, Sylvia.
Hello.
And we have your brother, Alan Markowitz, who is here in Toledo with me right now.
Hello. Hi. Hello.
Hello, sir. Good to have you here. Now, the thing that the both of you have in common, and this is like if they still had that game show, What's My Line, right, or something like that.
I've got a secret.
Yeah, I've got a secret. That's it. The two of you could show up, and they would have to figure out what your secret is. And the secret is that you are both the chair of the board for your respective opera companies. You, Alan, here in Toledo for Toledo Opera, and you, Sylvia, up in Chicago for Lyric Opera of Chicago. Now, that is really remarkable, and I can't imagine anybody else has experienced that sort of thing. Have you ever heard of anybody being siblings and being the chair of boards of different opera companies?
I have not.
No. Uh-uh.
And even if it happens again, they won't have COVID to be during their terms.
That's right.
So that will remain unique.
I was actually just with the head of Opera America, and I asked him that question as well, and he, in his memory, didn't remember any other such duo.
Yeah.
My brother points out, you know, we were the very lucky ones, and the heads of our opera companies during COVID. That was quite the experience as well.
Well, I want to ask you about that, but before we do that, let's go back to the beginning, because there has to have been something that sparked your interest, both of you, in opera. And I'm wondering if you can recount how you discovered opera and came to love it. That'd be great. I'll let you go ahead, Sylvia, because you're on the phone. You can't see me motioning to you, so you go ahead and tell us.
Actually, it was a love at first sight type of thing. When I came to Chicago to go to law school, I was given tickets to go to the Lyric. And my very first opera was Pavarotti in La Boheme. So I went not knowing what to expect. I mean, I've seen, you know, pictures of opera and so on, but nothing on the grand stage like at the Met yet or at Lyric. And I was just blown away. It was one of the most amazing experiences I had. And I still remember the snow falling, and I wasn't, quote, expert enough other than knowing Pavarotti's name. But after that type of introduction, who could not be in love with the greatest kind of theater that one can experience?
Mm. Yeah. That was before artist Kranich fired Pavarotti, right?
Right.
Yeah, that's a whole nother story that folks can Google if they want. But I was there at Lyric Opera Chicago while Artis was running the company, and I interviewed with her a couple of times when I was auditioning for the Young Artist Program there. And she was, you know, she ruled with an iron fist, really. But she had so much respect and love, I know, from the singers and the staff there at the company.
You know, although I'm the first woman chair of the board at Lyric, there is such a strong history of amazingly strong women at Lyric with artists and, of course, Carol Fox.
Carol Fox, yeah.
That it just feels like I was, you know, kind of completing, you know, the end of a very strong path that they've created for strong women in opera.
Yeah. Well, that's remarkable. I want to explore that a little bit. But first, I do want to hear from you, Alan, your formative experience that brought you to be interested in opera and running the board of an opera company.
Well, I don't know about running the board, but actually, we've never talked about this. It's the same La Boheme.
Oh, really?
I was in high school, and the English teacher, Phil Buell, took us. We had something called the Boys Literary Society. And took us to a dress rehearsal of Toledo Opera at the Peristyle, actually. And they were doing La Boheme. And at the end of the dress rehearsal, one of the people in charge came down and said, we need a couple of supernumeraries. Any of you guys want to volunteer to be waiters? Just stand around. So my friend Jim Wilson and I volunteered. And he said, come back at such a time, wear black pants, a white shirt, and a bow tie. And so we did. And to complete the story, I was always a pretty big guy, and my friend Jim was a small person. Anyway, so we came back, and we were told where to stand, and we were in the cafe scene when right. the sugar daddy gets the bill, and I'm standing behind him. And this person was typical opera buffo person, let's say a large person. And he is singing his view of the bill and then decides suddenly to faint from the bill. I'm behind him, and I had no idea this was going to happen. I caught him, and I could have won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor, not only because I was supporting him, but my look on my face was very, very real. And then the curtain closed.
And you knew from then on, you knew that opera was your thing, right?
Well, it certainly sparked my interest. And I had not seen an opera before, so I was more interested in musical theater at that time. But That's the same initial experience. And I until we just sat down and I heard Sylvia's story, I didn't realize it was the same opera. Now, I was a long way from Pavarotti, but I was more participatory.
But you were on stage.
I was on stage.
Yeah.
I actually knew that story, and I was waiting for him to tell it. I didn't remember, though, that it was Bohème. I mean, it's like one of the legends in our family.
That's so amazing that you both ended up doing what you're doing for your respective opera companies. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about your day jobs, because obviously that day job is not being a board president. You do other things in your life. Sylvia, why don't you tell us a little bit about you? You mentioned law school, so we're assuming you're a lawyer of some sort.
Well, for many years, I started off in academics, but then for many years, I was the legal director and then the executive director for the Midwest region of a Jewish civil rights organization, and was very much involved in advocacy on behalf of, you know, civil liberties, peace in the Middle East, et cetera, et cetera. I helped write the human rights ordinance for the city and for the county. I sat on the, I was a commissioner on the Human Rights Commission for the state. And then I returned to academia at the University of Chicago and also at Northwestern, where I was associate dean at Chicago, and I taught as lecturers in law and in the area of religious liberty. And I did that up until about a year and a half ago, when I decided that I was going to retire. and taught my last seminar, but I still remain very involved in the university, and spend a great deal of my time involved in civic matters here in Chicago. From, of course, the Lyric to the Art Institute to the university to the symphony, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful city, and it's a wonderful way to give back to something that has really given so much to me in my life here.
Yeah. One thing that Alan did tell me is that you do a lot of traveling to see operas around the world.
Well, my husband and I really love opera, and we love art. We collect a great deal of art. And one of our organizing principles of travel is to follow the music. And indeed, during COVID, we've been quite sad because that's put a bit of crimp in our style. But we do go all over the world enjoying opera very enthusiastically, as you know, as well as taking in museums and other cultures throughout the United States and the world at large. It's a wonderful way to organize travel. Some of your listeners are interested in doing it, and we enjoy it very much.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Alan, let's hear from you. Now, you're a doctor, is that right?
Yeah, I'm a professor of medicine at the University of Toledo, and I'm an internal medicine doctor, and I've been doing that since 1971. I came here in 76.
Wow. You came to Toledo, or
well, I grew up here, but then I left.
Okay,
thinking I would never return.
Little did you know,
life looks different with a family. Toledo looks great with a family, and when I accumulated a family, then we came back here, and my parents were here, so the kids had grandparents here, and like living in Toledo.
You mentioned your parents, and they were Holocaust survivors, right?
They were.
Yeah. Yeah, I did some reading online of the tribute that you both held for your father, right, at the University of Toledo, and it's definitely worth, I think, exploring. I wonder if that had any kind of impact on, you know, your preferences, your musical preferences? Like, I mean, did you have music going on at home when you were young?
Well, Sylvia and our late sister Diane took piano, and we, of course, had a record player with lots of records and so forth. And I wouldn't say we had an especially musical family growing up, though. Would you, Sylvia?
No, although, we have children who certainly followed in musical pursuits. But I will say that our family, one of the things that I reflect on often is how our parents came to this country, really, was in a sense less than anything. We came with my brother. He was born in displaced persons camp in Germany, but they had really nothing except for the values that were instilled in them by their parents, which education, culture, music. I mean, my father comes from a very religious background, and one would think that is quite different than living in a modern secular world, something called Hasidic background in the Jewish religion, that in many ways is closed off. But its most valued aspect is, you know, intellectualism and curiosity. And my mother came from also, you know, a very, you know, lovely, sophisticated kind of upper middle class background where she was exposed to various things. So I think our parents instilled in us a great love of academics. You can see we both followed along in that area, as well as culture. And it making sure a few years after coming into this country that I was taking piano lessons, you know, says a lot.
Yeah, and definitely, I think, influenced your choice to serve as chair of the boards. Now, Alan, how long have you been with Toledo Opera? Was it around the same time as Sylvia a couple of years ago, or?
No, I've been on the board for many years. I think there was a little brief period of being off the board. There was some sort of a rule that you had to rotate off.
Yeah, that's.
I would say it goes back 25 years.
Between, okay.
You know, Jim Mina's time for most of his duration.
But as chairman of the board.
Oh, no, just the last, this is my end of my third year, and that's what our terms are.
Oh, okay. So they're going to kick you off soon, right?
I'll be the immediate past president. I'll be a supernumerary.
You'll be like the godfather. Everybody will come to you asking for advice. do you guys ever call each other up and share advice or share ideas about governing your respective boards?
Well, we certainly commiserated during COVID.
Yeah.
Our problems are quite different in scale, but they're similar in nature.
Yeah. Well, we've mentioned COVID a few different times. I wonder if, and maybe Sylvia, you can start with this, because I know that Lyric tried to react during COVID with, you know, tried to come up with a plan in order to keep the music alive, as it were. Can you talk a little bit about how that impacted, how the pandemic impacted what you were planning to do with the company?
Yes, you know, it was a very difficult time for everyone. I mean, let's, you know, first of all, acknowledge, you know, the death and the illness and, you know, the terrible tragedy that COVID has been. And I am so pleased that now it seems that medical intervention is really easing our way hopefully out of this pandemic, if not just being able to lessen it. But when it came to performing arts, COVID hit particularly hard. And not to compare tragedies or, you know, bad luck, but Lyric was, I think, out of all opera companies, if not all performing arts companies in the world, hit the hardest because we were about to put on our very own produced Ring Cycle.
Mm.
It was expected attendance from around the world.
Oh, yeah.
And the whole thing had to be canceled. That was actually my first official act as incoming chair. I mean, I was just starting that, you know, right then, was to stand on the stage with our great Anthony Freud, general director of the Lyric, and tell the rehearsing cast, orchestra, tech crew, et cetera, that the Ring was being canceled. And I know that that was a dream for our longtime, now former conductor, music director, Sir Andrew Davis. And on top of that, we had other things that were lined up, not just his retirement, but we also were bringing the Joffrey Ballet into the Lyric Opera House for the first time. And we were introducing a brand new music director, the delightful dynamic Enrique Mazzola. So all of those events were wrapped up in what was supposed to be the first, you know, which ended up being the first 6 to 9 months of COVID. But we did not give up. We did not go dark. And we actually created one of the most dynamic alternative seasons that taught us a lot and involved us in ways in both virtually for opera, as well as some really innovative in live performances, such as performing in an underground garage
yeah.
Twilight Gods, that I could explain later. It was truly like going into Hades. But it really ended up being because of the enormous courage, creativity, and hard work of the whole company and staff, one of the most interesting times that Lyric has had.
Yeah. Well, the Twilight Gods performance in the garage, that was Yuval Sharon, right? He was
That's right. Your new artistic director up in Detroit.
Yeah, and a couple of weeks ago, I went to see his version of La Boheme, where they did it in reverse order with the acts in reverse order. It was really interesting. And something that I thought really worked, and it occurs to me that, you know, that's your magic opera right there, La Boheme. So I'm curious what you are going to take from that experience, from that pandemic experience, or what you think will be taken from that into the future as the company moves forward. I mean, as you mentioned, we're starting to get, hopefully see some light at the end of the tunnel, fingers crossed on that. But is there anything that happened during the pandemic that you would like to see, you know, remain on the stage or even go further on the stage?
Well, I'm thinking you're directing it again to me. One complete changeover was something that we all spoke about, which is our virtual presence. But we never really were able to flex our muscles in that direction because of preoccupation with, you know, carrying on live opera in the way that we've done grandly for many, many years. And I would say really no one's better at it in the world right now than we are. Anybody who hasn't been to Chicago to see Lyric is really missing a world-class experience of entertainment. But we reached and are continuing to reach hundreds of thousands of people virtually on our platform now. And we were able to experiment in ways that we really hadn't been able to before, like I said, because of time and preoccupation in other ways. And that's never going to change. We even produced a full-out movie, not just a video and so on, of Pagliacci, like something that I felt should have been nominated for an Academy Award, where, you know, we used the Lyric Opera House itself as as the setting for, you know, that particular story. And it's really one of the best opera things I've ever seen. And if you haven't seen it, I'll send you the link or a copy of the DVD. I think you'd really appreciate it.
Yeah.
So I think that virtual aspect has changed. Also, I think, like, just even the openness I say that Lyric is like suddenly really, truly the hottest ticket in town. And we've had sellout after sellout as we've returned to the stage, and a lot more excitement about, I would say, certain kinds of new operas, experimental operas. We were also able to infuse a lot of our ideas for IDEA, which is inclusion, diversity, equity and access, and culminating in the performance of Fire Shut Up in My Bones, which was our last opera, which we've just seen a whole new culture at the Opera House, and an amazing, I would say, excitement around our performances. Even the editorial board of the Chicago Tribune has cited the Lyric and Enrique Bartola in a huge editorial as leading the city in terms of its preeminence during COVID and after COVID, as being a great place to come and enjoy culture. And we were very, very proud of that.
Yeah.
And remind me, after you turn to my brother, you know, to talk to you a little bit about COVID and what happened to us with Fire Shut Up in My Bones, because it's truly a story of the show must go on.
Wow. I have to say, Sylvia, I can easily see why you're the chair of the board there at Chicago. You're a walking advertisement for all the wonderful success that they've had there. So kudos to you. Alan, I'll turn it over to you to talk a little bit about your experience with Toledo Opera during the pandemic. I know that Toledo Opera, you know, has responded, albeit on a smaller scale than Chicago, obviously, but you've done a lot of online work, and you also turned a lot of things to the advantage of being able to present operas like Blue that you have going on, and addressing the African-American community specifically with a lot of that work, increasing diversity. Also, the upcoming production of La Traviata, which is happening very, very soon, may have already happened by the time that we put this on the website, but I think we'll get there before that. Happening very soon, featuring world-class artists. I mean, there's so much to talk about. I mean, where do we start? If we go back to, say, you know, the beginning of your tenure, which was
Right, just before COVID.
Yeah.
So we started, Macbeth was my first opera as the president, and I was very proud of the production. It was a fantastic production. And we were all looking forward, extremely looking forward to Scalia Ginsburg, the next production, paired with Trial by Jury, which I'm a big fan of Gilbert and Sullivan. And we had all kinds of activities and seminars associated with Scalia Ginsburg. And certainly it was to be a example for the opposite of what's going on in our national politics now. And so that was a bitter disappointment that we had to cancel that and the rest of the season. So we turned to other things. At the start of my term also, we had a task force. It was called the Tootie Task Force, Susan Block and the late Dave
Beckwith
headed that committee, and they interviewed hundreds of people to get feedback to Toledo Opera and where we could go with that. And we started working on a new vision message and governing principles. And so we did that with a large committee and a lot of input, and I'm very proud of that. It's going to be in the program book for the opera, La Traviata. And then we translated that into updating our governing body for the board and also for the employee handbook. So that took in all the inclusion things and diversity that we had going. We had a, just before we started, we had a advisory committee of diversity, and that has become actually a standing committee of the board from just being an advisory committee. So we've worked hard on that. Also, we've worked hard with our resident artists. But let me get before that. Our resident artists do education. Many people don't realize that we have a huge education program for preschool and lower school students. Opera is a story for the preschool, and opera on wheels for the older children. The opera is and the resident artists put those on, and they deal with thousands of children in Northwest Ohio, all the Toledo Public Schools and some of the regional schools. And with the COVID, we were unable to do that, and yet we had these resident artists. So we've tried to put them out into the community. We had the opera outdoors, and that's going to be a regular program now at the botanical gardens and the farmers market. And then they're available to sing Valentine's, Christmas carols. We try and put them into many activities, participate in area programs. So we've been working on alternatives. We've had some things online. We did do Il Trovatore, and that was available live and online. So we've struggled, though. But the other thing that we've been able to do and been very encouraged on, I think you can get back to Sylvia because she should brag on this aspect, was our donors, our supporters, our corporate supporters, our private donors, and the government stepped up and kept our opera company alive and thriving.
Yeah.
And the success of fundraising, which is the fuel for all performing arts, in our particular case, I think the kudos belong to our executive director, Suzanne Rorick, and who has kept a lean and mean opera company of employees and workers going, but has also taken every opportunity to get grants, to get support, to get donors. And the donor community has stepped up, the corporate community has stepped up, and the government has stepped up. So, and here we are. I think we're emerging, and we're going to put on a full opera with Metropolitan and Lyric Opera quality stars. I think Katie Lewick is going to be at the Lyric not long after she's here.
Yeah.
So that's been what we've been doing during this pandemic, and that's been our challenges and how we've met them. But I think Sylvia should brag about her financial support at the Lyric, because I found it kind of overwhelming.
Yeah. Do you ever get jealous of the fact that she's working with this much larger pool of resources?
I also hear the headaches, which I'm not sure she'll want to discuss, but then I'm not envious of some of the headache problems.
I guess it's a double-edged sword, huh?
It is.
The next question I was going to ask was about fundraising and the difficulty of keeping the opera company alive during the pandemic, especially. And Sylvia, you spoke of all the wonderful things that Lyric Opera of Chicago did during the pandemic, and the ways that you shifted and adapted. I mean, what was the fundraising climate like for arts organizations there in Chicago during the pandemic period?
Well, I echo my brother. The enormous gratitude to our donors and our patrons in terms of their generosity cannot be overemphasized. With the canceling of the Ring, we created something called the Hero Fund, since that's what the Ring was all about, and beginning with folks contributing to a canceled Ring cycle, which is not just the most expensive thing that an opera can put on, but as whether it's a small company like Toledo Opera or a very huge company like the Lyric, opera is the most expensive art form that there is. And we can thank the government for its help during the pandemic. We took a very active role in advocating that performing arts organizations be covered. Large ones like ours were not covered at first. We really had to get to work on that. But we're not like Europe, where the government does support a huge percentage of opera and there's symphonic orchestras as well, and there are other cultural institutions. Indeed, in this day and age, whether you be a university, a museum, or an opera company, contributed revenue is really the vast majority of how one's able to sustain these amazing civic treasures. Revenue through tickets cannot possibly support the cost. And as I said, not just the generosity of our amazing company and our administrative staff, because I'm going to tell you, those folks really gave of themselves, whether they be the orchestra, the artists, the people who provide you the tickets, the development staff, they were working from home and alone and doing all sorts of things that kept us going. It really was our donors who just allowed us not just to survive, but as my brother used the word, but as we've been saying, we don't just survive, we thrived, and we're continuing to thrive. And now we're in a COVID recovery campaign. And it's nice to take a little while. It's also the number while we went live at Lyric, culminating in, as I said, the amazing Fire Shut Up in My Bones that we co-produced with the Met.
You have a story to tell about that, right?
Oh, yes. And actually, I guess this is a good time to talk about this story. But we had, many fewer productions to put forward. One of the big things that was so important to us was to make sure that each production live was safe. And in a huge opera house, Lyric treats almost as many people as the Met seats. It's a huge opera house. We have, well over 3,000 people. And we did not have one outbreak, not anything. And I give a huge amount of credit to Anthony and the rest of the team for that as well. So can I tell my, I'll tell my fire story about COVID. We were checked in terms of COVID as in our audience, but here we are in our last performance. Those of you who maybe do not know, Fire Shut Up in My Bones is Terrence Blanchard's first opera. He's one of the most influential figures in American jazz. Libretto's Cassie Lemons and baritone Will Liverman, who is another graduate of the Ryan Opera Center, helped create this amazing story of Charles Blow's life, his memoir. Those of you who know the New York Times columnist. And it is a huge cast, a black, mostly black only cast. It's just an undertaking, almost at the level of, if you can imagine, the cast of Porgy and Bess, yet and more. And a white knuckle kind of thing, so emotional. I would say if it was on Broadway, it would be running for years, if you understand what I mean. And I'm not just promoting it, it's really that kind of a show.
Yeah.
So people sometimes think that we only could look backwards to the heritage operas that are grand. This is grand opera that we are now creating today. And it was amazing. So what happened is literally in the midst of our production is that both our stars came down, our main stars came down with COVID. So Will Liverman had COVID, and LaTanya Moore got COVID. And as I was saying, we were selling out all the time. And there were others as well in the production who got COVID, from the chorus to more minor stars. And pretty soon we were just playing musical chairs about who was playing what, trying to do the production with less people. We were doing Tosca at the same time. And it was sort of a very unique and interesting Tosca that is called history breaking because our two leads were both black and our woman, our conductor was a woman, as a conductor was a woman in Fire. But literally the day of the production that was going on Saturday night, we brought in Justin Austin to play Charles, the main lead, who had been the cover in the New York production at the Met. And he was actually in rehearsals at the Met for Hamlet. and just flew out and just walked into that park. And then we, of course, lost our Billy as well, who's the main female lead. And so LaTanya Moore, who is actually also, you know, quite brilliant, was replaced by one of our ROC Ryan Opera Center alums, Whitney Morrison. So it was truly one of these, the show must go on. There was not a flaw in any of these productions, which shows the level of expertise that does go into opera. And we're just very proud of our company and what happened here at Lyric.
Well, and that story that you tell of all that is sort of like a larger version of the story that we've often heard, the make or break story of singers coming in and replacing other singers and, you know, the things that go on behind the scenes that even the audience isn't necessarily aware of all the dynamics going on there. So it's a grand story, definitely, for a new opera, which is so interesting. And to see opera adapt, as you say, Sylvia, it is the most expensive, one of the art form that sort of unites all the performing arts in one place. It has been transformed, I think, by this experience, and there are new pieces all the time coming along, addressing all of these issues of, you know, equality and diversity, and in the case of La Traviata, issues of abuse, issues of women's rights, all that sort of thing, which Toledo Opera has shown a great big light on through different seminars that they've done online. By adding a cultural or a community outreach person who has done a lot to address the needs and concerns of the community. Alan, do you want to talk a little bit about
Yeah, that's one of the other things that we've expanded on during this COVID time. In the past, we've had a Tuesday talk. We've had a pre-opera, an hour before the opera, an expert giving the outline and some history of the creation of the opera and so forth. But in the last 3 years, actually going back to when we had the world debut of I Dream, we've expanded on community engagement type of seminars and discussions of interviews and panel discussions, not just one thing, but also dealing with the issues, not just the opera, but the issues that the opera brings up. And actually, one of the things that maybe will turn to our advantage is the opera Blue that's coming in August. We had that scheduled for last year, and of course, that had to be canceled or removed, fortunately. And I think that's turned out to be a good thing because we've had lots of community programs related to that set up, but we have time to do even more preparation going into August. And also it'll be a standalone situation for entertainment, I think, for Toledo in that area. And we're going to outreach to the other regions, other cities in the region. But we had an interview with Tazewell Thompson and Janine Tesori, the creators of Blue. Actually, going back, when we first heard about Blue at Glimmerglass, we sent Levy Aldinger to see it, and we booked it on the spot. And I want to say we booked it on the spot before the George Floyd things and all this kind of stuff. And I think we also heard that the Lyric was doing it, what, at the Ryan, Sylvia, or something? You were doing Blue? And we actually had a board trip planned to go there to see it before we were putting it on. Anyway, so it turns out that the interview was so successful that both Mr. Thompson and Ms. Tesori agreed to come to Toledo for the weekend of the opera, which is, if you're familiar with the arts, Janine Tesori is probably the hottest composer in the country right now. She's got several hits on Broadway, and the Metropolitan has commissioned her to create an opera for them. So this turned out to be probably an advantage. It gave us much more lead time and much more intensity to dealing with that. Also, we created a movie of local Toledo people that had dealings with the police and interaction involving citizens and involving police in the movie. And we've presented that, and we're going to submit it to film festivals. That's been quite a creation. It was done with Madhouse. Sometimes things turn out to be like a jujitsu, an advantage. You use their strength against their weakness and so forth. So,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I think going forward, we're going to do on a regular basis a lot more citing the relevance of even the classic operas to current issues. And there's a lot of those that people don't realize. I'd like to do Susanna in the Me Too era and deal with that. That's an example.
There are a lot of examples.
Yes,
I think in the classical canon of operas. I mean, you're talking about Western European music and musical theater, and so much of it is wrapped up in the as a product of its time, right? Reflecting what the attitudes were at that
time.
That's
particularly true of Gilbert and Sullivan. You have to really know what's going on in England and in the opera world at the time, because their music is very satirical and references more classic operas.
Yeah, you don't get the joke unless you know what they're talking about.
Right.
Yeah.
I want to pick up on something my brother was talking about, because this is something that I'd say Al and I have talked personally a great deal about. Blue proving up, and actually a new opera, and I would call it, more chamber operas are what we call it at Lyric, where we go into smaller houses, like the Shakespeare Theater here, the Harris, even the Goodman, because they work better in smaller audiences than in our large auditorium. Even something called Factotum, which grew up in the pandemic, which is inspired by Rossini's Barber of Seville, also done by Ryan Arndt, Persona alum Will Liverman, who was one of the greatest sources behind Fire, but also with DJ recording artist Kay Rico, and it's a hip-hop, barbershop, gospel, funk, kind of R&B type of thing that takes place in a Southside barbershop. The same thing, workshopping the issues around police brutality, the generational differences that Proving Up in Blue and those kind of performances also bring forth is really important. We have something that we started at the Lyric called, very periodically called, Inside Opera, that I host from time to time. And we dealt with the issue of women in power, interviewing both Renee Fleming, who's a longtime leader here at Lyric in Chicago, in terms of being our artistic consultant on many of our projects and longtime on our board, and Ann Ziff, who's the longtime chair of the Met. And we're going to be following it up with something that you both were just speaking to in terms of heritage operas, where we put on Carmen. The philosopher Martha Nussbaum will be discussing with Anthony Freud Carmen and the different ways that the powerful woman, the strong woman, is she demon, is she strong, and how different generations have come to view that opera in different ways. And the difficulty of do we censor things that we don't agree with in opera? Some folks have even suggested that we not show certain heritage operas at all. Or do we have a greater understanding of different times when we put on these opera, and particularly newer productions? We don't change things, but you emphasize things differently. And I would come to suggest that, the great composers and librettists, even in heritage operas, when there was so much censorship, we're often able to pack a punch. For example, Mozart, let's say in The Marriage of Figaro, when he starts to talk about little count, his servant is challenging the great count, and he managed to get it through his censors of his time. Now, this was taking place around the time of the between the American Revolution and the French Revolution, and even in grand opera that was then being supported by nobility, there were some ability to get some political statements through that are maintained in beautiful music and great acting to this day. It's such an interesting subject to explore.
Absolutely.
My brother said, whether it be the Me Too time or, you know, other kinds of sensitive issues that we're dealing with in today's world.
For example, are politicians making Faustian bargains?
Well, that's been going on since the beginning of time.
Right.
That never gets old, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the things I'd like to also bring up, though, is you contrast the Lyric and Toledo Opera in our size and scope. But one of the things we're proud of at Toledo Opera is that we have our singers are the quality of singers that you can see at the Met, the Lyric. Some of that, I think, was some of the groundwork was with Jim Mina, our artistic director for many years, who had a real good eye for up-and-coming singers and was able to create a relationship with them so they come back when they're established, like Katie Lewick. We have an opera gala every year to also raise funds from our supporters. And this year we have Chauncey Packer coming, who's been at the Met and the Lyric. So one of the things that when you come to Toledo Opera, you do hear, at least in the leads in the first row of performers, the highest level available in the country.
Well, not only that, you might even, as is the case with Katie Lewick, get to hear her sing this role for the very first time. She's trying out her Violetta in Traviata here in Toledo, you know, eventually hoping to take it elsewhere. But I think it's a great opportunity for folks to see her take on that role. And it's not just a walk in the park. That's a difficult role.
Yeah. Absolutely. That opera happens to, like many, many other people, be one of my absolute favorites. You know, it's so beautiful. That role is fantastic. She had been at Lyric Queen of the Night a few years ago, not in our most recent production of The Magic Flute. And next season, as I think you mentioned, she is going to be at the Lyric, starring with Lawrence Brownlee and Count, or who she's going to be the Countess. And I'm very excited to come this weekend in celebration of my brother's birthday and his last opera as chair at the Toledo Opera, and to come to enjoy the opera. My brother and sister-in-law have come to Lyric, as have their kids who live here in Chicago. it's really a wonderful thing to share this as a brother-sister act. It really is.
Well, going back to that, you mentioned at the beginning we're children of Holocaust survivors, and one of my favorite Lyric experiences was The Passenger
that
they put on, and getting to meet the woman whose story it's based on.
Well, it's just a case in point of how opera can have such a profound influence on folks, and not just somebody like yourselves who have direct experience with Holocaust survivors, but for those of us who have had absolutely nothing to do with any of that, but see it and feel it and can live some of that experience through the power of music, through the power of theater.
Interestingly, our dad became very interested in opera later in life.
Probably
because my oldest child is a singer, and she started out in opera at the University of Michigan and the Cleveland Institute of Music. And so that's how I got re-engaged. I don't remember if it was before or after I became on the board, but she was cast in one of Toledo Opera productions.
And that's what we have in common too, because, and these are two best friend cousin people. My youngest also studied opera. Actually, I would say my middle, I have a wonderful blended family now of five, plus in-laws and grandchildren, and we both do. We just finished what we call a Passover Seder holiday, where we, just our family is alone. We're like, you know, like 35 people sitting around the table, but having said that, they both are singers, and now Andrea, his daughter, is a cantor at a major congregation here in Chicago, and my daughter is an officiant in Los Angeles, and they both often sing together. Mm. And indeed, a cantata was written about my dad's life that had been performed by Andrea. And actually, I think one time also Deanna participated, but they both had studied opera and still participate in music. But I think, you know...
Let me just interrupt. The cantata is Tikva and was performed in many venues around the country, but in particular, one of the years in Atlanta at the Martin Luther King Memorial. It was the center performance for that.
Wow.
Yeah, and indeed, going further back, as I mentioned, and my brother discussed at the very beginning, in my father's family, which is very, very religious, there actually had been cantors, chazans. So within that tradition, also the voice, the power of voice, and then in prayer, was very important. So we sort of were making full circle back to the discussion that we began with.
Well, and there have been some wonderful cantors who also became famous opera singers. You know, you think of Jan Peerce or you think of Richard Tucker,
exactly.
Especially.
Exactly.
Yeah, there's not so much of a difference, I think, between those two styles of singing.
Sylvia had preparation for this role at the Jackson Hole Music Festival. Sylvia, you want to mention that?
Well, I had also been the chairman of the board of the Grand Teton Music Festival, which is a fantastic summer festival in the Tetons in Jackson Hole. And it is led by the great maestro Donald Runicle, Sir Donald Runicle, I should say now. And it sort of was for many years a bit of a well-kept secret. It was sort of like summer camp for some of the best instrumental performers from orchestras across the country, various principals and teachers and so on. And in the last several years, we decided that it'd be nice to share that a little bit more broadly. And it's been cited in the Wall Street Journal, the Guardian, the New York Times is one of the best music festivals in the country. So yes, for several years, I was chairman there. And it's really a lovely, lovely experience. And you get the great outdoors as well.
I should brag on you. You were the transformative chairperson.
I think we can safely call her transformative, you know, no matter where she's working. Yeah. You know, I think that the Grand Teton Festival does a radio series because I get solicited for that program every year. But after hearing your pitch, I'm going to go back and listen to some of the programs. So we'll see how that goes.
Wonderful.
And, you know, back in her bio history, she mentioned that she was on the Civil Rights Council. But in referencing Scalia Ginsburg, she was appointed by the Cook County Democrats to the Human Rights Commission and by the state Republicans to the Human Rights Commission. I think that that's the only person in Illinois who has that kind of a distinction.
Yeah, I didn't mention this, but one of the ways, there's a term in Hebrew in religion called Shalom Bayit, which means peace in the house. So my husband and I usually have fairly different politics. I'll let you guess who's more liberal leading and who's more conservative leading. You know, he's an economist and a longtime law professor in law and economics and has a big economic consulting firm. Anyway, so what really has unified us is our absolute love of opera and our absolute love of art and so on and so forth. And so, you know, it's better than arguing on Sunday mornings when you're watching the television shows, right?
Yeah. Well, Alan, you alluded to the idea that we don't see relationships like that anymore, like between Justice Ginsburg and Justice Scalia. Where, you know, they often were at odds professionally, but personally they were great friends and united
exactly
by their
role model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Role model. And they're wonderful. My husband, I knew her slightly and my husband knew him fairly well. So, and knew her a bit. So I wish we had more role models like them today.
Yeah.
It would really be inspirational to us all.
Yeah. And you know, her son, Jim, runs a record label in Chicago.
Right.
Yeah.
In Chicago. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And she was a great, both of them were great. They also, you know, had a lot of their relationship revolve around opera.
Yeah.
By the way, the other thing we were, this is just, you know, and then I'm going to have to run in a couple minutes, but another thing that has been really interesting to me in the last several years in opera that we're doing here in Chicago, but I think this is across the board, is that the whole of opera, you know, we've been referring to it as great theater. And, you know, I think many times people have an image of just somebody standing there and singing, and maybe there's some beautiful sets. But as an interactive, wholly realized art form of many different kinds, I think that opera is realizing and seeing a new day. So it's a very all-encompassing experience. And I find that to be very exciting. Like, you know, the dance in Fire, for example, or like, you know, the redo of the Magic Flute. We did the Barry Kosky Magic Flute here, which is, this, you know, that uses silent film imagery and you know, in this, you know, grand, fun opera, making it much more relevant to today's audiences, but, you know, still splendid in terms of its cultural heritage. I just think that it's not your grandpa's opera anymore. Even if it is a heritage opera.
Well, and also there's the new techniques, the projected sets, I think allows opera companies like ours to put on productions with sets that you might not be able to do in physical sets. And as a counterpoint to what Sylvia just said, especially in the Italian operas, sometimes I like to just listen to wonderful singers singing a beautiful language. Mm-hmm. And not even looking at the super titles. You can read the synopsis of the opera, but sometimes, especially for the Italian ones, I just love just listening to these voices speak that beautiful voices in a beautiful language. It's a great experience. So there's all the new things and the new relevance things, and then there's just the sheer beauty of artistry in trained voices singing a beautiful language from a fantastic composer.
I'm going to pick up on that because you're inspiring me to think yet more. Like Lyric has been doing, has taken it upon themselves to do musicals, like West Side Story, some of the great musicals, and it's usually tacked on to the end of our season. And what people have been so astounded by are the voices and the acting. That's the other part. It's not just the sets and the, you know, there was the increase in really interactive acting on the sets, but the voices that, you know, whether you're listening, when you're listening to Traviata or to West Side Story, also with your headphones on. And indeed, we were speaking a bit about Barry Kosky when I mentioned the Magic Flute. Lyric, this upcoming season, is doing a production of Fiddler on the Roof that was done in Germany, originating there by Kosky. Not as a musical, it's a full-fledged opera. And those who love the musical are going to love the opera, but those who love opera are also going to recognize it as such. I have the feeling that we're causing a great deal of confusion. But it's a fully staged opera. And I think what my brother just said about voice, is transforming people's view of opera, because when you hear some of the great musicals and some of these great operas like Traviata's going to be this weekend in Toledo, the beauty of that kind of training and performance, as opposed to things being always so mic'd up, and et cetera, et cetera. But there's also great acting and stuff, I think, is attracting new and young, you know, newer and newer audiences across the board.
Oh, and Porgy and Bess, which we put on a couple of years ago, was the original crossover,
right,
Broadway
exactly.
/ opera.
Yeah.
I think now
exactly.
It's really taken its place as an opera more than a Broadway production, although it's opera on Broadway, I suppose.
There are so many things that we could talk about, but I think we've touched on some of the issues that people would be curious about, given your situation, your unique situation as chairs of your respective boards, Alan Markowitz, chair of Toledo Opera's board, and your sister Sylvia Neal, who is chair of Lyric Opera of Chicago's board. I feel like I'm the you know, aside from you two, I feel like I'm a bit of a touchstone here because I sang in Chicago for so many years, and I've been in Toledo for just about the same amount of years now. So it's great to see those worlds come together. I want to thank the both of you for talking with me today. And Sylvia, you're coming to Toledo. I hope that, you know, we get a chance to see you and looking forward to meeting you, possibly.
I am too. And you have an open invitation to come back and visit your home grounds, and I can't wait to tell the crew back in Chicago about you and your pre-Ryan Opera Center, but in our Young Singers program.
Anybody from the 90s still around over there, Sylvia?
I was just wondering. But maybe in the rehearsal department, some people would remember me. Yeah.
Well, we'll be excited to host you here one day, too.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure.